This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachowiak. For those of us tuned into the proceedings of the legislature over the past session, names like Phil Berger and Tom Tillis are household words. But inside the Capitol building, the name Jerry Cohen is even more well-known. He's a man fondly referred to as the encyclopedia of the legislature, and he bid adieu to his colleagues after 37 years of drafting bills as special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. Jerry's career in politics started well before he graduated from UNC Law School. In fact, his political ambitions were ignited during the explosive summer of 1968. Jerry was a gopher at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, just awarded his gallery pass when the riots erupted, and that was the beginning. Over the next hour, we will meet Jerry Cohen, former special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. Jerry, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be here, too.
Let's start at the DNC National Convention 1968. What brought you there?
Well, I had a high school civics teacher who was a McCarthy delegate to the National Convention, and I had worked some as a volunteer in the McCarthy campaign in the spring of 68, and she invited several of her students and former students and friends out as volunteers to the National Convention. So I trekked out there, spent a couple days in Buffalo at my uncle's house on the way, and then went on to Chicago.
You were also inspired by a speech by a guy named Saul Alinsky, a very famous organizer at the time.
Right. In February or March of 1968, at my high school in Hartford, the school invited Saul Alinsky, a Chicago-based, I guess, rabble-rouser organizer, to speak. And I got to hear him speak, and we had a meet-and-greet after that. And I can say that really had a big influence on me, really the first exposure, really, to a political activist. And I then got involved in the McCarthy for President campaign, which was probably not the path that Alinsky wanted people to follow. I think he was more of an agitator than working in a mainstream political campaign, but that's what I started off with then.
He was working as sort of outside, a grassroots organizer who wanted communities to get themselves together and in many ways create a new order. So working outside the political process in a lot of ways was Saul Alinsky's work. A guy who worked inside was Al Lowenstein, who was very important and instrumental in that anti-Johnson campaign, the anti-war campaign of the late 60s, and he also had an influence on
it. Yeah, Allard K. Lowenstein was really my political mentor all through my first, 7 or 8 years in Chapel Hill. Al had graduated from UNC in 1951 or so and had gone off. When I met him in the summer of 68 in Hartford, he was already Democratic nominee for a Long Island congressional district, and he found out that I was starting in college in Chapel Hill later that summer, and he offered to talk with me, and he came through Chapel Hill 2 or 3 times a year and met with me. So I learned a lot of things. He was the one that encouraged me to run for mayor 2 times, which were very unsuccessful. But he said, I remember him telling me, good people never give up. You have to keep trying and keep trying and keep trying. And he was basically a Pied Piper in the Dump Johnson movement in 67, 68.
Interesting to think of you sort of inspired by these men and others on the political scene. Were you politically conscious? Were you politically active before that, before you heard the Saul Alinsky speech? Had you been thinking about it? It was, after all, the 60s. Hard to ignore that stuff.
Well, I grew up in a Hartford suburb. My parents were unaffiliated voters. My father had gone to school in Chapel Hill and gone back to Hartford. And no, I wasn't really politically active at all. Maybe I would have viewed myself earlier on in high school as sort of moderate to conservative, which was what basically my town was. So many people take their attitudes from their parents or where they live.
That's the insurance capital of,
yes,
of the nation. So, you know, it's I would think a fairly conservative kind of a place. You did come to North Carolina the fall of 1970, right?
68.
You were there. And then, so what did you do then? Did you become involved right away?
No, I was really not active in anything political. I'd go to meetings of various things. Activist undergraduate. When the voting age was lowered in 1971, that's when I really got involved in local politics in Chapel Hill. When I decided to stay in North Carolina and attend law school, which is another long story.
So. You work with Howard Lee, first African-American mayor of a southern city that was majority
right.
white.
My main interest, really, besides election law and electoral politics and legislative politics, was public transportation, which I've worked on over the last 30 or 40 years. At Chapel Hill Transit was really Howard Lee's ideas, and he was the spark plug. But I worked with him actively in both the February 73 transit referendum in Chapel Hill and getting Chapel Hill Transit started in 74. I ran for Board of Aldermen, now Town Council, when I was a second-year law student in 73.
And you won.
Yes, and sort of there were five people running for four slots. I finished second and was really an active campaigner. The person that lost that race was probably familiar to many of your listeners, although he's gone for a long time and recently returned. That's Alexander Julian, who is a very nice fellow.
Nice fellow. Doesn't design my clothes, but but he does. But he has for many others. So tell us a little bit about how you got here, because, again, Hartford, Connecticut, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, there is a connection, though, and it was mostly basketball.
My father started at Carolina before World War II. He got drafted out after 2 years, sent to the Pacific, came back in 1946, one course short of graduation because the Army had sent him to an intensive Italian program at Michigan State, but he couldn't find any housing and never finished that last course. But I remember him back in Hartford, his hometown, starting sometime in 1962, talking about that new basketball coach at Chapel Hill, Dean Smith, and I think he kept up for 6 years. What I remember is a constant drumbeat of Dean Smith, Dean Smith, Dean Smith. I think we went to a couple of basketball games at Madison Square Garden. The Heels used to play at the Holiday Festival over Christmas, as I recall. So I think I had applied some other schools, but I think my natural path was to follow him to Chapel Hill. He went back to Hartford. I did not.
So you came down here, you got active in public policy anyway, worked with Howard Lee on his pet project, which one of them was to get public transportation into Chapel Hill. Then you ran for alderman. You won two terms, right?
Yes.
Decided to run for mayor.
Yeah, I ran for mayor in the middle of my first four-year term and again in the middle of my second four-year term. And I got beaten miserably the first time by Jimmy Wallace and lost to Joe Nassif and Bob Epting in a very close race in 79, and I basically took a career path. I decided that change. I resigned from the town council after 6 years and decided I would focus myself on not running for office. I'd run that rabbit to the end and focused on my academic and professional interest in legislatures, which started when I was in high school, of all things. I subscribed starting at age 15 to the Congressional Record because I was sort of obsessed with legislative politics as a teenager, probably not the normal path for a teenager in Hartford, but I used to bring it on the school bus and read all about the nuances of parliamentary procedure. Obviously, an oddball way of getting into things, but it was really my career interest.
Talking to the Encyclopedia of the North Carolina Legislature on the state of things. Jerry Cohen is my guest. He retired after 37 years as a special counsel to the General Assembly. He writes the laws, puts it into language. Well, what's the surprising part is not that you left electoral politics for the legislature, but as a 15-year-old subscribing to the Congressional Record, reading it on the bus, I wonder why you were interested in the fray to begin with. It sounds like you've always been kind of keen about the nuts and bolts.
Well, I've always liked the sort of nuances of government. You know, I had a skill of memorizing things, train timetables, parlimentary rules, all sorts of things that are sort of oddball and maybe eccentric. You know, if you had a list of, I don't mean to self-diagnose, but if you had a list of eight symptoms of something like Asperger syndrome, you'd probably check six of the boxes for me. Trouble making eye contact, all sorts of things. Memorization of train timetables.
Okay. Acela, 3 o'clock, outbound. No, I'm sorry. Well, so you're interested in that kind of thing. I mean, it is fascinating to me that you would then even think about electoral politics. Was that fun for you? I mean, it's a much different – it seems to me those are two very different animals, the kind of public life of a politician versus the more behind-the-scenes work.
I was horribly shy in running for office 4 times. I got over being shy, and I consider myself a good public speaker, but it was hard at the very beginning. But once I sort of threw myself into the fray, and I quit at 2 wins and 2 losses. If this was baseball, I'd be in the Hall of Fame.
That's pretty good. On the State of Things today, I'm talking to Jerry Cohen. He's a former special counsel to the General Assembly here in North Carolina, earned a reputation as the encyclopedia of that body after 37 years, I should say, of writing the laws and getting that those legislative ideas turned into legal language. We're going to talk more about Jerry's early political life and his life in the legislature on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking with Jerry Cohen, former special counsel to the General Assembly. We talked a little bit about your brief period, but somewhat successful career as a politician in Chapel Hill, and then onto the legislature. Tell us a little bit about what that job involves, special counsel to the legislature.
Well, the legislature, North Carolina General Assembly, has basically a nonpartisan central staff model, which about 40 states follow, which means serving members of both parties, both houses, and I really enjoyed doing that. I mean, it's obviously a career path choice. Some people can do that, some can't. If I had a problem with it, I would have lasted about 3 weeks. But I started as a staff attorney for 4 years, then was bill drafting director for 31 years, responsible for supervising 40 people. I mostly drafted myself in local government and election law and legal rules. As special counsel, the last 2 years, I basically worked for leadership of both parties, majority and minority leaders, speaker, president, pro tem on special projects, plus working with rank and file members.
So what is it? So like a legislator comes up and says, hey, Jerry, I want a law that stops people from polluting the river, but I don't want it to be too expensive. And then again, it's got to have some chemicals. What's the name of that, Jerry? Is that what happens? And then you turn that into a law, or how's it go?
Well, you meet with the member and find out what their idea is. You have to identify the problem first. Not all problems have solutions, and there's also solutions in search of problems. But it's meeting with the member and finding out what their interest is, referring to the right person in the specialty to draft something that meets their needs. Their drafts might come from a personal interest. It might come from a lobbying group. It might come from a constituent. It might come from a national organization. There's all sorts of sources of request. A lot of members may have run for office based on a particular thing that motivated them.
And then again, you have to sort of turn this into legal language. Is any of your concern whether that legal language would run afoul of the Constitution? Do you have to know that?
Well, yes. I mean, we try to advise members if there's any problems with the state or federal constitution. Their members may be more or less familiar with the federal constitution at some level. The state constitution, however, is filled with little minefields and restrictions that I don't know why any new member would have any reason to know, but we try to advise them on what kind of local legislation is permitted or not, what kind of federal things, what kind of impact will this have, to make sure that after it's enacted, people will understand what it does. Although sometimes the legislative process, as part of compromise, produces legislation that's mushy and hard to understand because that's how it coalesced to majority support.
And you, I guess you, so you're listening to, and now at a certain point, the political leadership, right, on both sides. So that's when you're trying to write this language. I mean, do you sit down there and have long meetings with these guys and they're saying, well, a little bit of this, no, a little bit. I mean, who fights over the words? Because you're the expert. You're the legal expert who's trying to tell these guys what it means. And they're telling you, no, not that, more of this.
Well, working with a particular member, whatever the leadership wants of both parties really doesn't affect central staff in any way. It's the political process that decides whether a bill is going to pass or fail. But, you know, we try to work on something that will, you know, be legally correct and understandable. And work with a member to accomplish that goal. Sometimes the project will be abandoned. Sometimes we'll find that it isn't needed, that it already is the law, or that there's a constitutional issue with it. But ultimately, it's the member that decides. The legislative staff is neither, you know, we're not judges. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a political process and a judicial process after that. Our job is to give the best advice. Sometimes it's taken. Sometimes it isn't.
We're hearing more and more about lobby groups that write legislation. You mentioned that earlier. And, of course, that's gone on forever. Is there more and more of that, groups like ALEC and other lobby groups on the left and right that come to you with the bill already written?
Well, sometimes we'll get the bill already written. You know, there's the First Amendment. People have the right to lobby. They have the right to propose legislation nationally. I don't have any problem with that. You know, it's good to have outside input on, you know, somebody trying to draft something. I find that outside drafters often don't know what they're doing. So usually when somebody – I always had a rule. When somebody submits a draft on the outside, I ask the member to write or submit like two or three paragraphs on what the goal was, because sometimes the drafter didn't understand anything, and getting a couple paragraphs on what the goal was helped me analyze the bill draft to see whether it actually accomplished that goal. Sometimes members did not understand the implications of what someone asked them to do.
Now, you came to this job as someone with a political conscience and somebody who had been active in politics. Is it ever difficult for you to draft legislation that you simply – I mean, you know it's your job. You don't want to get fired. But what do you do when you have to write a law that just is killing
you? I never had any problem with that. You know, I started off in graduate school in political science after my undergraduate degree in Chapel Hill, and I was interested in legislative politics from academic side. But I dropped out of grad school after a year because I had no money and the job prospects were bad. And I got a Morehead Fellowship to go to law school at Chapel Hill. And I was really, really interested in legislative process and legislative politics. And our model is nonpartisan central staff. And I didn't have any problem with it. I mean, I chose that career path. I could have chosen other paths. So I decided I wasn't going to have a problem with it. Yeah, sure, there were things I liked and didn't like, but that never affected my work.
Are there, there must have been some pretty wacky legislation. I mean, what's the funniest bill you ever had to deal with?
Well, the funniest one is a story from probably in the late 80s or early 90s. Ted Kaplan from Forsyth County, Winston-Salem, introduced a bill. Background, there's a statute with a whole bunch of holidays listed. The normal holidays you think of, you know, there's things like Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, Jefferson Davis's birthday, all sorts of stuff with really little legal significance. And Ted Kaplan from Forsyth County, who, as I am, is Jewish, wanted to introduce a bill to make Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, a state holiday. Now, my job wasn't to decide whether it should be a holiday or not. And we had discussions like, well, what day is that going to be, since it's on the Jewish calendar and starts at sundown? So we had a sort of funny discussion of that. Well, he gets the bill out of committee and on the floor, and I don't see any particular reason why non-Jews would really understand Jewish holidays, nor, since this was largely a list of people, Jefferson Davis's birthday, Washington, Lincoln, all sorts of people. And he explained the bill on the floor, and Foyle Hightower from Anson County, Representative Hightower, stood up on the floor, and Foyle had a reputation of asking questions that really needed to be asked, but people were embarrassed to ask them. And he asked Kaplan, can you tell me something more about this Yom Kippur person? Was he a Democrat or a Republican? So that's my favorite story.
That is pretty great. Kaplan have an answer, or did he just roll his eyes and sit down?
I don't remember the answer.
Hard to know.
Sorry.
Hard to know. I want to hear some more about your personal story, too, here in North Carolina, because you met a new Elizabeth Edwards in law school, right?
Actually, Elizabeth Ananiah then was in my dorm. She had just transferred in as a sophomore, a junior, and I was a sophomore in Hinton James on South Campus. So she I knew her very well as an undergrad and then lost track of her. She went to grad school in English for several years, and then when I was a third-year in law student, she and John were first-year students, and we really kept up on and off through her death.
You also, I think you're one of the first. It's interesting because the guy who's credited with direct mail campaigns, of course, is Jesse Helms, Richard Viguerie worked with him on direct mail, and then, as we know, they passed on that great information to a guy named Ronald Reagan, who used it to great advantage. But you also got an idea of mailing addresses and lists of potential campaign donors when you were a young politician, right?
Yeah, a friend of mine, Charlie Dean, who I did not discover for another 30 years or so, since it wouldn't have been important then, was Howard Dean's brother, lived in my dorm at Hinton James also the first 2 years. And Charlie was the only paid campaign staffer for the McGovern campaign in the fall of 72. And while McGovern carried two counties in North Carolina, one of them was in Orange, and Charlie decided to leave Chapel Hill that next spring. And he knew I was thinking of running for town council, and he gave me a file box, basically handwritten or typewritten, of all of the, and it was probably 1,000 names of all of the McGovern supporters and contributors in Orange County. And he gave that to me and said, use this for fundraising. And I sent out a mailing to the whole list with my campaign announcement and a fundraising solicitation. And I'm sure that had some impact. I've been active in Chapel Hill politics, but I'm sure that had an impact in helping me succeed in my first campaign. So, you know, it's so much of life is being in the right place at the right time.
Well, the idea that you would take any help from a McGovern campaign worker and succeed, to me, is yet another miracle in your in your career, Gene. Jerry, you know, one of the more interesting parts about that, again, this transition from electoral politics to kind of behind the scenes, legislation writing, the technical part of public policy making. Your first year now, as you made the transition in the legislature, what was that like for you?
Well, it was different. I had just been reelected in my second term in the town council when I started working for the legislature. And one of the reasons I resigned after 2 years was it was becoming difficult, both from a time standpoint and some conflicts of interest also. But I got involved. I was interested mainly in local government and election law. Those are the two areas I really specialized in, and I obviously had some experience in it, both being an elected official and running for office. So I really focused on those two areas, and I continued to work on those two areas even when I was a manager and a special counsel.
What were the conflicts of interest?
Well, you know, there'd be local legislation that Chapel Hill was interested in, and so I couldn't work on that. And, you know, I tried to toe a line that there wasn't any question of conflict of anything. Others might not view that as a conflict of interest. I don't know. But I eventually decided I needed to completely separate myself from being in public office. So after a little less than about 2 years exactly into my 37 years, I resigned from the Chapel Hill Town Council. In fact, I think the mayor thought it was a stunt or something because he told me that they weren't accepting my resignation. I can't remember whether that was Jimmy Wallace or Joe Nassif, but he said they weren't accepting my resignation. And I said, well, that's fine. That's up to you, but I'm not coming to any more meetings.
So you'll notice an empty seat, whether you accept or not. You make this run for office at the local level. You talked about an interest in local government and also transportation. When you ran for alderman and then mayor, did you have aspirations for higher office, or was that how you saw yourself?
No, I ran for office largely because I wanted to get a public transit system established in Chapel Hill. That was my main thing. In fact, I look back at the Chapel Hill Weekly Election Day issue last week. I'm a pack rat and kept that. And I was talking about public transit, and none of the other candidates was. Alexander Julian talked a little bit about it, but my main focus was public transportation, and that's been my really career focus, even running through now with regional transit.
You know, we keep seeing the polls talking about people's perception of politics and politicians over the years, and it does seem to me that the career and the profession has fallen to about its lowest point in a long, long time. You've been at the center of this for nearly 40 years. What would you say, how have things changed? Has it always been this? We always sort of have the perception that things are worse now than ever, and yet perhaps not.
Well, I think one of the things with social media and more sort of democratization with a little D of access to information is people see more now about what's going on. I don't know if the process really has changed in any way, campaign contributions affect legislation, that kind of thing. I don't think things have really changed. Obviously, there's more going on. There's more public knowledge. Bills are more complicated. You know, back when I started, we had a manual typewriter, scissors, a copy machine, and rubber cement to draft bills. Now you can cut and paste from things people have emailed you and write a 50-page bill in a half an hour. But I started with a manual typewriter.
Well, so obviously things that have accelerated in the way we transmit information, though I wonder if things are more or less transparent today than they were 37 years ago.
I don't know. Being on the inside makes it hard for me to see the forest for the trees, so I actually can't answer that one.
How about the idea, and again, there's this idea, you mentioned it just a second ago, the influence of money on public policy and about and on public officials, a sense many years ago, four decades ago, many politicians were interested in public policy. They had personal agenda. They had ways of seeing the world, and they wanted to see that enacted, and they represented a body of thought, came to the legislature with that. Now, they're more or less paid activists, paid shills for whatever side of the argument they're on, and they have less passion themselves. They're simply sort of on the take. Would you have any sense of that from the inside, a legislator who really felt it and somebody else who's just they got elected because that was where the money came from?
Well, I think money has also always had an influence on politics. Pre-1974, there was really little campaign disclosure of finances. There were stories about bags of money being given by operatives to candidates for various office from governor on down. So, you know, I think there's always been that. To pretend that somehow this is more corrupt than sometime in the past, maybe now we have more access to information to know what's influencing legislation.
Talking to Jerry Cohn on the state of things. He retired after 37 years. Most recently, he was special counsel, I should say, at the North Carolina General Assembly. And that meant that he wrote legislation, wrote the bills, translated those ideas into legal language. So who did you like to work with? Who did you have most respect for?
Well, I think there are four or five people that I consider the best to work with. Partly was their interactions, their work with staff, their devotion to the legislature as an institution, the legislative process. I think four of them I can identify right off. Liston Ramsey, longtime Speaker of the House. Kenneth Royal, who a longtime House and Senate member from Durham, who incidentally was one of the four people on the committee that hired me in 77. Joe Hackney, longtime House Speaker and House member from Orange and Chatham counties. And also Art Pope, who there are people who both support and detract from him. But I found him very good to work with because he came in, asked questions. He looked over what you sent him. He read the legislation. He came in with suggestions, sometimes good, sometimes not, and attempt to make the process better. So those are the four people I can think of right off. There are a lot of other people I worked with. I don't mean to single out just white men in my group there because there were a lot of black members. Mickey Mishaw, who's been there since 73, other members also I worked with. But those are the four that I like to work with the best.
Okay, who are the biggest knuckleheads? Come on, you're retired.
Well, some of them are in prison or have been there.
Okay, that's good. That's a good answer. That's a good way to put that. What about, because we see this kind of wacky legislation, you know, demand that kids write cursive, the nipple law legislation, stuff like that, which is sort of, how long has that been kind of an issue for you? I mean, do you sit around the break room with the other law writers and say, oh, look at this one?
Yeah, sometimes staff will laugh at ideas. I mean, that's not our job, but sometimes things are funny. I mean, I personally like cursive writing, you know, researching old deeds and old historical documents and statutes, they're all written in cursive. So if you were a historian or, you know, a historical researcher, even working for the legislature on old laws, you know, deeds, research, they're in cursive. If you can't read and write cursive, you miss out on stuff. But whether the legislature should be dictating that cursive be taught? I don't know.
I was going to say, Jerry, I like salami, but I wouldn't make all elementary school students eat it. That's
well,
the
there's a saying about the legislature being like sausage, so that would fit in with the salami.
Those who love the law and sausage should watch neither being made.
Right.
And you can attribute that to anybody you want. On the State of Things today, Jerry Cohn's former special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. We'll talk some more about his career there, get some stories about his time in the North Carolina legislature, and that all happens on the State of Things. Please stay with us. It's the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today talking with a man finally referred to as the Encyclopedia of the Legislature, special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. Jerry Cohn, retired now after 37 years of service. So most recently, you know, voter election law, you said earlier, was always very important to you, that kind of legislation you paid attention to. Voter ID bill, of course, now a law in this state, very controversial. I just wonder if you had any feelings about that.
Well, I mean, it's not my job to decide whether it should have it or not and remind listeners it's not effective till 2016. But part of the problem is identifying what the problem is. And I know that one common misconception, and when the governor had his press conference to sign House Bill 589, he said two things, that one reason for photo ID is you can't fly without a photo ID. Well, that simply isn't true. TSA has a backup process. I've known plenty of people who've been allowed to fly commercials since 9/11 within an ID. TSA will let you show other documents. They'll have a friend vouch for you. The same kind of things that perhaps a photo ID system like some states have would let you present other documents at the polls or let other people that know you vouch for them. That would be the analogy as opposed to making up that you can't fly without a photo ID in a press conference or you have to have a photo ID to get Sudafed. Well, you do, but it doesn't have to be yours. I can pick up Sudafed for my wife with my photo ID, but I can't vote for her. So it's basically either things that aren't true, even though people believe them, or they're non sequiturs, true but not relevant.
I guess, but one of the other complaints too was that there was no real problem. There was not a lot of examples of fraud, except for absentee ballots, which of course favored Republicans, and that wasn't changed. So that led to a lot of critique about why this legislation even, you know, came up in the first place.
Actually, absentee voting law was changed, I think, to make it more protective. And absentee vote, as a matter of fact, I just sent in my absentee ballot. I've been voting by mail for years. I just sent in my absentee ballot application this morning. Ballots go out September 5th, and I voted by mail for years because it's easier. But, the whole concept, you know, the other thing is, there's obviously a disparate impact. You know, for the elderly, for instance, my mother-in-law had, you know, retired. Her driver's license had expired. The law does allow you, if you're over 80, you had an ID at 70, to keep using it. The problem is, for many elderly people, having an ID and finding it are two different things. I don't know if my mother-in-law knew where her photo ID was. She hadn't driven in years. She liked to go vote in person, and my wife would take her to vote in person. But, you know, so we try to find her birth certificate, and part of the law says, well, we'll provide a photo ID for you and we'll waive the fee for your birth certificate. But of course, a recent study showed that 48% of people voting age in North Carolina were born out of state, so we can't provide them a free birth certificate. So some of the connections between that, whether there's a problem or not, whether there's fraud or not, let others judge that. But the question is, does the solution match that? Is the solution so overbroad that it winds up stopping? So maybe there were some number of fraudulent in-person votes. I haven't seen any evidence of that, but some people say there is, and I'll accept that for a minute. How many tens of thousands of people will be stopped from voting because they don't have an ID, can't find it, can't get to DMV that's open one day a month in a rural area, you know, but the election legislation, actually, there are some much greater impacts that aren't even seen. You know, for instance, I think the greatest impact, an election administration is sort of like an organism. It, you know, the election laws govern what kind of lines you're going to be in, how long the voting period is. One thing that's overlooked in its disparate impact on race is the legislation ended straight ticket voting, where you could mark a box at the top and vote for all the partisan candidates of one party, something North Carolina never didn't have. Since 1926, when we adopted the Australian ballot and the state took over ballot printing, it was there. Prior to that, parties printed their own ballot, which just had their candidates on it, and you dropped it in the box from an operative. But there is an enormous difference in political behavior between blacks and whites as a political science. I've studied that, looked at precinct returns, because they note when you mark the straight ticket. And there's an enormous difference. A lot of people say, well, you should vote the person, not the party. Well, that's great in the abstract. But, for instance, my analysis showed that 85% of blacks voted a straight ticket and only about 45% of whites. Thus, going in a long ballot state where you've eliminated that will lead to much longer lines in black precincts and white precincts as people spend five or six times as much time marking their ballot. There are about 20 precincts in North Carolina that are entirely black, where 95% of the voters marked a straight ticket. Now, you can say that's good or bad, but in fact, the black political experience in North Carolina is far different than the white. The political process is far different, whether it was organized out of self-preservation, but in fact, it exists. And to say that somehow that this change just has the person over the party, in fact, its impact will be much longer lines, as was given in testimony on the Senate floor and in black precincts, as well as ballot drop-off, where people stop marking the ballot at some point. North Carolina is one of the longest ballots in the country. We elect more officers than all but four or five other states.
But, you know, getting back to, so, and I think you've articulated a long list of criticisms of the voter ID law, and it certainly points to some of the reasons why its critics might see political reasons behind this law rather than strictly public policy. But let's get back to Saul Alinsky now. Let's look at the possible response to this and think about people like Saul Alinsky and their kind of community grassroots organizing. Is this the kind of thing that spurs people to action? They see what's up. They see what the intent is, and it actually motivates people to register, vote, and change the way things are going?
I think that it can be used as an organizing tool. If people feel, rightly or wrongly, that their rights are being taken away, then I think you may see the Moral Monday movement as an outcropping of that, whether right or wrong. I think you can see some of the tactics of that and the kinds of things that Alinsky suggested. I don't want somebody to say that, well, you know, therefore, since Alinsky might have suggested something, I mean, he's been dead for decades, mm-hmm. so he didn't have any direct influence on anything. Right. I mean, people blame Alinsky for Obama, of all things, you know, so, but I don't think there's any, although right. I think Obama actually met with Alinsky also, so.
I believe so.
Because they were both Chicago politicians.
Yeah. I mean, certainly Barack Obama will credit him as one of his inspirations and influences. And you know, for better or for worse, he talked about this idea of grassroots, people taking control of their own.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier in the program, I had the chance to meet with Alinsky when he spoke to my high school in Hartford, Windsor, actually, my senior year in high school. And that had a lot of impact on my thinking and understanding problems and how to analyze them.
Well, what effect did it have on you? What did you take away from that meeting?
That people should be involved, that they shouldn't accept all answers given to them as true. They should investigate. They should learn. And if they feel that something needs to be changed, they should become active to change it. You can come to that from a liberal or conservative standpoint, that one should be involved in politics.
Over your decades in politics, in the belly of the beast, as it were, are you more or less confident that we as individuals actually have that kind of authority, that we can make a difference still?
Yeah, I think electoral politics is still very important. There are other channels for activism, but I think voting is very important, that's your chance to directly influence the process. There's obviously other ways to influence it. But I think voting is very important, and I encourage your listeners to make sure that they vote, that their friends are registered and vote, regardless of what their political backgrounds are, that society is better when more people vote. That's my opinion.
And when you look at particularly in off-year elections, the paltry turnout, I mean, well under 50% in off-year elections, I mean, you talk about a safe district. Is there any such thing as a safe district where less than half of the eligible voters actually turn out?
Well, most, I guess, with gerrymandering and stuff, most districts are safe, but there are a lot that are in play, you know, this fall, as with every election.
So we're talking about some of the more hotly charged political issues, and we know there are lots of motivations behind them, but there's many, 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 many bills that pass in each session, and I would think a vast number of them probably have some real legitimate use apart from a political that never make the radar. Have you seen bills? What kind of legislation have you seen go through the legislature that might only affect one tiny corner of the state, but may have worked for the good of that place?
Well, legislature passes 500 or so bills a year, and some are aimed at one specific problem, and some may make things better, some worse. Some may be because somebody has an axe to grind, or somebody feels that the taxation on their business or the regulation on their business or personal life is inappropriate or maybe needs to be strengthened. So, you know, I can't think of anything specific right off, but I think it's, you know, important that people participate in the political process. Nothing wrong with asking for legislation, but the process should evaluate it.
In your years, what do you think has been the most influential, for better or for worse? Not the best, not the one you like the most, but the most influential legislation that has had the biggest effect on this state?
Well, that has to be the state budget. And I've seen 37 of them, and they have policy in it, both direct policy and also what you fund is policy. So I'd say the state budget has the greatest impact on people, whether it's environment, their education, public health, various things. So I think that's the most important legislation.
When people talk about not wanting to be engaged in politics, not wanting to vote and pay attention, sometimes they point to a process, and the budget process would be a prime example of something that looks so chaotic, so crazy, and so partisan that they think no good can come of this. When you look at that process, obviously it's messy. We made the joke about sausage making and lawmaking looking pretty much alike. What do you think about it, though? Messy but effective? Is this a good way to be doing the people's business?
Well, if you have 170 members, you know, if you had a process where all 170 members had impact at all levels in the process. Part of legislative organization is people are elected to leadership roles, whether it's committee chairman or leadership, and they direct policy and work on developing the legislation. Again, you know, I was in the forest, so it's hard to see the trees, but was it Franklin or somebody said, you know, about democracy being messy? I'm getting the quote wrong, but the only thing, you know, democracy may be not be the best, but it's better than anything else anyone's ever thought of. I don't really have the quote right.
Yeah, but it's something like that. But is it? And I should point out that we are talking to the Encyclopedia of the General Assembly today on the state of things. Jerry Cohen is my guest, retired after 37 years of special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. You know, that's a good question. You have people coming from all over. They have been elected by the people, and that's, of course, what this and any legislature will say, whether you like what we're doing or not. We represent a majority of the opinion or a majority of voter sentiment in this state. When you take a look at this year's budget, for instance, I mean, what's your take on kind of how that was worked out and what we've got out of that whole process?
Well, I think that this year's budget, you know, it's a lot of policy decisions made. You know, in terms of education process, what's the teacher tenure process? What are teacher salaries? What support staff does school have? What's the curriculum going to be? What about charter schools and private education? All of those are, you know, governed by the political majority. What kind of changes are being made? Are things adequate? I mean, they're all policy questions.
Talked about Al Lowenstein and Saul Alinsky being two people who inspired you. Is this important work to you? Do you feel like you have a role as a mentor as well?
Yeah, I've liked, at least through my Chapel Hill politics years and since then, have enjoyed mentoring young people, working on voter registration in college towns, both Chapel Hill and Raleigh with a big student population. I've tried to mentor younger candidates. This past year, when Montrevious King's candidacy was challenged in Elizabeth City by the local Board of Elections, basically that students shouldn't be considered residents of college towns, despite the fact that the census counts all students as residents of that town where political representation comes from, and they pay sales taxes and most pay property taxes. There's this fear of students, which I think is totally unfounded. Well, I took the attack on Montravius King, I took it as an attack on me, not me personally, but my sort of philosophy about young people. So I went down and I wrote letters. I talked to Montravius. He actually contacted me and Mark Chilton, who were both, Mark was elected as a student to the town council also, and we worked with him, helped him on his presentation preparation, along with a Durham group, Southern Coalition for Social Justice, worked on his presentation. And I went down and campaigned for Montravius in Elizabeth City and talked to people, wrote letters. I think it's very important for people to give back.
So what will you be doing? How will you be giving back, or will you, in your retirement?
Well, I'm not planning to run for office again, but, you know, I've been involved in transit issues, and that's what I really want to focus on. I worked on the 1997 legislation for sales tax in Mecklenburg County that led to their light rail system, very successful. I worked on the 19th Study Commission that came out with the 2009 legislation for sales tax on transit, and worked in the campaigns in Durham County in 11 and Orange County in 12. And I'm very frustrated that the Wake County commissioners have been foot-dragging the last 4 years. I voted for two of the four Republicans in 2010, but, well, they've started down the path. I have a neighbor, John Burns, who's running for county commissioner in Wake County. In fact, I met him because he came trick-or-treating at my house with his kids years ago. And I've found that the contrasts are very stark, and I think their changes need to be made there as opposed to a county commissioners who adopt resolutions opposing marriage equality and contemning state sustainability as some sort of United Nations plot. I'm being serious about that. Back in February of 2012, they adopted a resolution attacking somehow that sustainability was a threat to the United States, and it was a UN plot, like they were black helicopters. So
you're getting back to your roots, Jerry, after 37 years with the nonpartisan gloves on, they're off, and it sounds like you are ready for another active career. Jerry Cohen, special counsel, formerly of the North Carolina General Assembly, recently retired after more than 3 decades of public service. Thank you, Jerry, for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank, for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. Our program is called The State of Things. It's on the web at stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.